Hello and welcome to The Whole Health Cure, a space for trustworthy, science-based information on how you can live healthier and longer through the way you eat, move, think, and recover. I'm your host, Dr. Sharon Bergquist, a physician, scientist, and lifestyle medicine pioneer with over 25 years of experience in patient-centered clinical care. Our conversation today is a fascinating one about personalized nutrition, tech innovation, startups, and female founders that I'm sure you'll enjoy as much as I. I'm joined by Monique Nadeau, who's the CEO and co-founder of EatLove, a San Francisco-based digital health company specializing in personalized nutrition. EatLove partners with leading health systems, fitness companies, wellness centers, and private practices to deliver scalable, evidence-based nutrition programs that meet individual health needs and preferences. As co-founder and former CEO, Monique led Hope Street Group, a national public policy organization that harnesses technology to mobilize an extensive professional network outside of government to promote economic vitality. Her experience centers on building and growing organizations through deep collaboration with partners from across the country. Prior, Monique was an investment banker in London, Paris, and New York, and became the youngest managing director globally at Dresner Kleinwort Wasserstein. Monique's political work, including advising on presidential campaigns and for other national leaders, has centered on developing moderate results-driven economic policies. Monique has a master's from Harvard University. She completed her undergraduate studies at the School of International Service, American University in Washington, D.C., and the University Sorbonne in Paris, as well as studied at the University of Salamanca in Spain. Monique served as economic advisor to Senator Mark Warner and political appointee to former Governor Tim Kaine from 2006 to 2014. Monique, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Sharon. It's great to be here.
Monique, you have had such an interesting background and story, and I love to hear people's career paths because it's never a straight line. And I'm curious of how you went from really investment banking to public policy into the digital space. So can you fill in a little bit more between how that transpired?
So firstly, I was trying to get into heaven, I think, at the end of the day. So I always had a fascination with data and analytics, and then was very much interested in what impact we could have and looking at solving some of the big societal problems. So whilst it looks like I've been in banking and policy and now technology, I actually see a pretty clear line between the three. I was really fortunate to have great mentors who had already been in politics and had been in banking and really saw the connection around how do you evaluate systems? How do you implement changes within those systems? And then how do you create new solutions that perhaps weren't there before? I'd like to think it was a master plan, but I've always been attracted by some of these complex systems and problems, and that's where life took me.
And what kind of was the step that took you towards digital health?
I had, prior to my master's degree in public policy, I had worked in banking and I had lived abroad for many, many years. And so I was always very interested again in those core pillars of society. And so I had the opportunity coming out of my master's to work on a presidential campaign. That was my first sort of exposure to sort of like direct policy creation and education to the public. And then I had the opportunity to, first of all, I met some very interesting people. They were in the private sector, and they had started to create a group called Hope Street Group, which I'm really proud to be associated with. And it was the idea of taking best practice in private sector and then collaborating with the public sector to be able to disseminate those ideas. Evidence-based ideas that had been working out in the wild, if you like. When we first had started that, there had been some work on presidential campaigns, but my role was to come in and actually operationalize that. We were working on projects that were being noticed by leaders from the left and the right. We were fiercely bipartisan. We thought that those ideas should be disseminated broadly. And so from there, we really attracted the best and the brightest for each one of those sectors. So the group itself and the underlying mission was tied to expanding economic opportunity for all Americans and looking at those key drivers and the research that had come out of the work, the seminal work that had been done by the group, looked at health, education, and jobs as those key factors. And so I personally was very interested in health. And through that work, we had been invited by our chairs, who at the time was John Podesta and Ken Melman, to host off-the-record sessions for leaders around the Affordable Care Act. Initially, we thought we would host one of them. We ended up hosting eight over 2 years and creating that safe space, again, with the foundation of data and analytics. And that's why I smile, because it was tied very much to the work I had done previously. And from there, we hope to have made a contribution into that, the policymaking process. And it's hard to imagine that was, you know, 13 years ago, but it goes really fast. It was really an enlightening experience.
And from there to becoming an entrepreneur and starting Eat Love, how did that then transpire?
So I think it was at the nexus of what was happening in my personal life and what was happening in my professional life. So from my professional life, we were evaluating tremendous amounts of data. And one that struck out at me then as a new parent was that 40% of what children eat in the United States is devoid of any proper nutrition. That was a data point then as a new parent that I was looking at. And then I could see that in my everyday life, wanting, like all parents, to feed their family well. And then it occurred to me in these really late nights and these late policy evenings, and that why is it so hard? And I had reflected that as a banker and as a mathematician and as someone who had a tremendous amount of data that was available to me at my fingertips when I was in banking, I could look at historical data, predictive data, cross asset class data, and I didn't have to make a simple choice for what I was going to feed my family. I didn't have any of the data that was in the aggregate for me. I could look at a label and say, is that meeting certain requirements? But what I wanted was to be able to look across a broad context and say, what I'm doing this week is a really good for my family. And I'm able to navigate the preferences that we all have and my time constraints and who's going grocery shopping and who's going to be doing the meal preparation. So it was where all those worlds collided that I felt that I saw the opportunity and just how much everything was so siloed that there wasn't this overarching ecosystem and this nutrition intelligence that could go across all of those contexts for every eating situation, not just for that one moment that I'm looking on a label on a cereal box, for example.
Mm-hmm. I want to come back to the value of incorporating digital health into our lives and specifically around personalized nutrition. Before I jump into that, I'm curious, as somebody who has this great idea, which, you know, I think a lot of people can really relate to how you just described that experience, going from there to actually creating a company and a product and being a CEO and as a woman, how did you begin and what was that process like?
So I think investment banking had provided me with a great foundation. I had been fortunate to have had mentors and bosses who saw potential and were willing to invest in me, both professionally and then helping me to get the responsibility that I needed to prove myself. And so I'll always be very grateful for that. And then I'll remember how hard it was to take that opportunity and convert it into something meaningful that helped move my career forward. Through my work at Hope Street Group, I had developed relationships with incredibly smart, but also amazingly effective people who like to see ideas go from just that, an idea, and then actually implementation. So the very first kind of spark for the company that I help with others to build and create came from my mentors within Hope Street Group and actually came from research grants. So there was a lot of work to be done to understand what were the barriers to putting healthy meals on the table in a way that was supporting food as medicine principles. And from there, we spent our first year just on research. So it wasn't, and then the 3 years after that, just on development. So we did not actually have our very first paying customer for 4 years after we launched our company. And healthcare, for many, many reasons, at any time that you're impacting individuals at scale and you have privacy issues and you have just data collection, that's going to take a long time and to prove its efficacy. I would say that I was fortunate to be in an environment that was supporting innovation, that I could take an idea, I could get initial funding. It was from research grants and then also funding from about 20 CEOs who, like me, wanted to see this idea come to life.
Yeah, I was going to ask, you know, how you supported those 4 years. That's really impressive to have that level of support and to be able to build the confidence of the people who provided that support.
Yes, and I think it's not lost on me, nor should it, I think it should be on any of your viewers in your audience, that female CEOs garner just 1.9% of all VC funding. That was coming out of banking and then having a great career within banking. That was still a huge shock to me. And I think, unfortunately, during the pandemic, it actually has gotten worse. You know, it hasn't gotten better over the last couple of years. I was fortunate that I had an established network and that I could go to my network and raise and seek some VC funding, but I wasn't beholden to only one path. I could make choices. I think that any startup, for any person who's considering starting a company of their own, I do recommend to them asking yourself why. And for me, I felt like this had to be out in the universe, whatever form that it would take. And I quickly came to the conclusion that it needed to be for profit because technology investment and just attracting the team that we needed, having run a not-for-profit and then being previously for 7 years and then previously in a very for-profit, as is investment banking, it was very clear that to me, we needed a for-profit focus, but to be deeply committed to a mission of expanding evidence-based nutrition guidance to millions of people across the world. And so we had to navigate that over the first 4 years. It wasn't easy. You know, you always hear one of my favorite podcasts is How I Built This with Guy Raz. And I think if I ever get the opportunity to do that, I will emphasize to someone that it's definitely not easy. You know, you don't take a proper holiday for the first 7 years, for sure. But for me, it was, again, on the personal side, I thought I've got these diverse experiences and skill set, and again, had attracted very incredible colleagues early on that I thought, why not do this? It needs to be done. And if it's not me, who and when? So that's how it started.
Did you have moments of fear or doubt?
Oh, gosh. I mean, as a startup founder, that happens every day, even now. Even when we have closed some of our largest partnerships recently, you still have that. And I think it's healthy and you're constantly growing. And I like to tell my new colleagues, if you're not out of your comfort zone in the next 24 hours, we're not doing our job. And I think as a leader, I was really incredibly fortunate to train under Warren Bennis when I was at Harvard, who co-founded the Institute of Public Leadership. And he since has left us, but he distilled an incredible amount of knowledge and best practice. And, you know, he had advised at that point four of the last five presidents. So I felt like I had this incredible teacher, and we stayed in contact up all the way until he passed away. Every 2 years, I read his book on becoming a leader again. And I'm reminded that I'm a work in progress. So I think that's all healthy. I never could understand when one founder would see another founder and they would see each other at events or at conferences and they would be like, how are you? And the other person would be like, I just need a hug. Or how are you? And I used to always think that was a little bit odd. Like, I'm like, gosh, what's going on? Is there this secret society? And these are companies of now billion-dollar companies. These are not, some are, you know, it's from the CEO that has one employee to, you know, a founder who is now a billion-dollar company. And now I understand why they hug each other, because they've been through something that, unless you've done it, it's almost indescribable. I think that founders support each other from a mental health perspective, from a, you know, a collaboration perspective. So, yes.
What's the culture like in a startup?
I think the culture is what you make of it. I think as a leader, that's one of the single most important things that you need to do. And that's on top of all the other things you need to do, like make money and pay bills and hire and fire at times. I think culture is something that's living and breathing and you can't neglect it. And I think in a startup, when you're burning the candle at both ends and you are constantly pushing, you're asking all of us as ordinary people to do extraordinary things, because there's so many people who told you. And in our case, we had PhD mathematicians where we were looking to actually build complex algorithms to provide personalized guidance around nutrition, who told us what we were doing, and, you know, people I respected, that what we were doing was impossible. And I think it's one of the reasons why there are aspects of what we do that no one has been able to replicate to date. And that for us was, it's not that we didn't listen to, we said, yeah, it's probably really hard to do, but we're just going to do it because we have to. And I think it's that extraordinary will, I call it intestinal fortitude, is that you're like, I'm going to do it. And I think banking was a great foundation to know when you just have that drive. For me personally, different things have helped. But I think, you know, startup culture. One story I had, so I started Eat Love in Washington, D.C. That's where we incubated the company, and we spun it off from Hope Street Group. And then I moved out to San Francisco to be closer to my fantastic co-founder. In doing that, I remember someone saying, watch this. And they stood up in the middle of a Starbucks and said, I'm looking for a JavaScript engineer. I'm willing to pay X per hour. Who's willing to do it? And I need 10 hours in the next 3 days. And like three people stood up in the middle of a Starbucks and they're like, I'll do it. I'll do it. And I just thought, I've come to a world that I've never seen before, because I couldn't imagine doing that in Washington, D.C. or in Paris or in London or New York. So I just thought that was pretty incredible. And I am seeing the beginning of that, actually. I am seeing signs of that around all this evolution around generative AI, where if you're in Hayes Valley in San Francisco, and you start asking everyone at the boulange there, at the boulangerie, the cafe, you're going to find people who are going to be able to help you. So I just thought that was, I'd never seen anything like that. And so I think there's something in the water about finding that sort of concentration of very specific types of talent. We have colleagues all over the country, so it's not just in San Francisco, but still there's something about San Francisco that I think is pretty incredible.
Yeah, that sounds like an incredible environment to be in. And tech innovation in healthcare, it's, I think, going to be more in the future. It's already, I think, come a very long way. But can you just talk about where you think we are now? What do you think it offers and adds to the way care is delivered?
So I think there's been different phases of innovation with different services and products being digitalized. So even if we were talking 10 years ago about, you know, the marketplace starting with looking at buying goods online, right? Like I remember, you know, living in London, I had ruined my mother's Barbie doll when I was a kid. She let me play with it. And I stayed up because of the time difference, all night and bought a Barbie doll from like 1957 that she had had since she was a child on eBay and thought it was the coolest thing ever, right? And I think it probably wasn't good because you got a trader, banker trying to buy a Barbie doll. And so like I was definitely going to get the Barbie doll no matter what. I think now you've looked increasingly at services going online. And that was the evolution of the marketplace and building up trust between the provider, who is the provider of that service, which could be healthcare or outside of healthcare. I remember someone once told me, when you start delivering healthcare services and tools and support, you got to recognize that healthcare is regulated only second to the nuclear industry in the United States. That was one bookend of kind of my thinking. The other bookend of my thinking came when I was working in policy, which shows that if you look at the epicenter of healthcare in terms of new procedures and how they're done, to go from the epicenter to the periphery of a new technique or a new type of drug or a new approach, it's 17 years, what was the average, right? So if I could be in a different part of the country and the medicine that I'm being given or the procedure or the way it's being delivered could be dramatically different. And there's been evidence of this in different kinds of procedures. In technology, it's 18 months is the estimate. And so you have a part of the society and the economy, and yet healthcare is, what, about 18% of our GDP. So $1 in $5 that is spent roughly in the United States is being spent on healthcare, which is somebody's job, right? Which is often, you know, in communities around the United States, the largest employer. And yet, when you look at technology, things are moving very fast. They're never perfect. In fact, it's the opposite. They're constantly being iterated every single day, right? So what our platform delivers now compared to 3 months ago, compared to 3 years ago, is dramatically different. It's very different in medicine, and for many good reasons, right? You have to prove the efficacy of certain interventions. I believe in that process. So you want to make sure things are safe and appropriate for the patient. I think those were the worlds collide. And I would say right now, as someone who's sitting on the intersection of healthcare, wellness, and fitness, and looking at all the players within that and all the stakeholders, the wellness provider of the future, I think, is still up for grabs. And this is where I started to see around my work on the Affordable Care Act is that as we are looking at who's providing care, where patients are already going, think about where they're picking up their prescription, think about where they're buying their food. The sort of melding together of the patient and the consumer has definitely enabled the convenience of how that care is delivered to become on the forefront of a lot of patients' minds, patient consumers' minds. So there is a tension or a push to be able to provide technology in those places and to do so in a way that they are interconnected. And so they're not siloed like they were before. And I think that's the opportunity and the challenge, depending on what, where you're sitting in that arena. Are you in a health system where your average contracting process is 6 to 9 months after you've actually agreed commercial terms? Are you in the medical group down the street that's taking on risk now? So they're as a value-based, you know, more value-based contracts where they are looking at more interventions that they're willing to try and innovate and try more things. Are they a retailer that's looking at the millions of people that are going through their doors every day? And then how are they providing that omni-channel to be able to address some of their healthcare needs at the same time they're buying milk?
Yeah, and in a sense, Monique, like it makes sense to integrate the technology and the points of decision making when it comes to wellness, right? Because so much of our health is really determined by our habits. And some of this appropriately should happen outside of a healthcare setting because, you know, even if we provided 100% access to care, we would reduce premature mortality by 10% through the health system. I mean, the remainder is contributed outside the health system. So it's appropriate to as you're saying, to think of it as the intersection where, you know, that melds the consumer with the patient, because it's a part of our lives, right? These are lifestyle habits. So it makes sense that it's woven into the fabric of our daily lives. To give our listeners a sense of what technology enables, can you describe Eat Love a little more? Because I think the platform is incredibly sophisticated. And being in healthcare now for 30 years and seeing this evolution of first recognition of the importance of food, and then how do we provide access and services through typically it's dietitians, and then to now this power of digital technology and what would take hours for a dietitian to create with a press of the button, your technology can do. So can you just give an overview for a consumer of what is capable through Eat Love?
Sure. So we are a personalized nutrition platform, and we have both a pro version for medical providers. You mentioned that. Our mission is to make evidence-based nutrition guidance easily accessible for everyone. And there's only one dietitian per 5,000 Americans. So we need to look at, and I'm an incredibly strong proponent of the work that dietitians do, but when there's only one per 5,000 Americans, we need to give them the tools to be able to support more patients in a personalized way, in a way that they can actually integrate with their life. For your audience, Eat Love enables a very simple onboarding, working with a provider. You have access to an app. That provider can set a nutrition prescription for you down to 100 macro micronutrients. And the reason why that's important is because, Sharon, if you had diabetes or you had, you know, you were postpartum and you were breastfeeding your baby, or you had issues with cardiovascular, your situation is going to be very different than mine. And so at a very simple level, how do we make your health goals overlaid with your preferences? Maybe you're vegetarian, maybe you're 100% plant-based, maybe you have a child or yourself allergic to tree nuts, so you're never going to want foods that, you know, brought into your home that have tree nuts that would put your family at risk. How do you take those goals that are extremely abstract today? I mean, when was the last time any of your audience had looked at what was the last, you know, dietary recommendations that are put out every 5 years, right? You hear them and you're like, okay, I know a Mediterranean diet sounds good. I should do that. What does that mean? So what Eat Love does is takes that evidence base, that latest science, and actually makes it available to you for every eating situation, so that if you're cooking at home, we're providing a dietitian approved meal that could be something culturally relevant to what you want to eat, all the way to something that you just assemble in 3 minutes and you got to grab it and eat as you run out the door, to over 100 national restaurant chains where we tell you what you can put in your burrito bowl at Chipotle or what you can have for breakfast at Starbucks, all the way to ready-made meals if you're someone who doesn't have time to cook or doesn't have the inclination to cook. Those ready-made meals will be brought to your home. And for folks that are managing a chronic disease, or they've just recently been released from hospital, or they're a caregiver, those kinds of points at different parts of the care continuum are really important. So we wanted something super practical. It starts with a provider. We refer providers. You can sign up on the web version, but the app is through providers. It's a managed service. And we are now in more than 500 organizations across the country and outside the US. And you're able to take that with you on your phone for the 200 decisions that we make every day around food and diet. That if you didn't, for a lot of people, myself included, it can be very overwhelming. On average, women think about what they're going to feed themselves and their family 46 times a day. So just the cognitive overload, and I'm sure there's a lot of your audience and men too, thinking about what am I going to eat? How am I going to improve athletic performance? How am I going to build muscle? All of these different things of looking at where food come into play, Eat Love is taking all of that. We evaluate close to 5 million dietary factors in less than a second. And if you think about it like Spotify, where you have your preferences, Lena, which is our AI nutritionist, is evaluating all of that information in addition to the way you're living your life and what you need, makes a recommendation, and then we're fully integrated with Amazon, Instacart, and Walmart. So we've tried to take that end-to-end, super practical. How are you going to save me 90 minutes a week so I don't have to plan? How am I going to have confidence that what I'm eating is actually meeting my nutrition goals? If I'm 100% plant-based, how am I making sure I have enough iron? How am I making sure I'm getting the energy that I need and the calories that I need for myself and my family, for example? So those were all of our considerations. Leftovers, do I like batching? Really committed to reducing produce waste by 2/3. So our recipes are talking to each other. You know, they're looking at it and saying, how do I reduce that grocery list from 70 items to 50 items? And at the end of the week, I don't have sad carrots or wilted broccoli at the bottom of my refrigerator that I'm just going to throw out. That's money and that's time that you went to go grocery shopping.
So let's take the scenario that a person has diabetes and they want to eat, obviously, to manage their blood sugar. They would first start with seeing a dietitian. The dietitian would help them get on the Eat Love app. And then together they would identify their goals, what percent of, you know, say, macronutrients they would want, the percent of, or how would they then create those goals together? How's the app designed where they can specify those goals? And for that person, how is this the point of differentiation from, I think, the model we're used to, which is you walk out the door from the dietitian's office versus now that you have this AI-powered technology? Like, what are the points of differentiation that can help you move forward in being really successful in your eating plan?
So right now, and this was the case when we started Eat Love, it still persists today, that if you are diagnosed with diabetes, you're going to get a pamphlet, you're going to get a piece of paper, and that's going to give you perhaps some food groups that you can eat. Maybe it will have some sample products, but you're going to have something that's static, right? It's going to be, and I saw this, I mean, when I was looking at whether I start Eat Love or not, my grandmother went through the process and they gave her a handout and she looked at me and she said, I'm vegetarian, what do I eat? And that was very meaningful to me because I thought, now I have to start a research project, right? And I did. I worked for 3 weeks. I built out a binder for her. The binder was what she could eat. I mean, I'm not a dietitian. I work with incredibly smart dietitians, but I knew enough around general guidelines. I mean, now that was kind of like the, not even an MVP, like the beginning of the idea. I had another family member who has celiac disease who said, oh, could you do that for me? Which was an entirely different binder. So, I mean, and I had a job and kids and I was like, okay, there's got to be a better way, right? I'd seen, as I said, the power of technology. So I think putting the individual at the center, and it's not just they have diabetes. If they're working, and it could be with a dietitian. I mean, Eat Love has essentially two versions. One is a medical version, which is a clinical tool for MMT that can be provided in conjunction with a dietitian and possibly a physician. We're powering lifestyle medicine programs at different health systems and medical groups and working on various projects that are not just a one-on-one, but a one-to-many. So I think that's important to differentiate. We also have a fitness version, which is general healthy diet, national guidelines that are available, where we are working with fitness facilities to offer general nutrition support as a one-to-many model. So we have one partner, they have 80 locations, 200,000 members, and their premium plus membership includes Eat Love. But again, it's not MMT, but for them, if the average American is eating 1.6 servings of vegetables a day, and with Eat Love, they're following national guidelines and they're able to further personalize it for their everyday life, that's a huge improvement. On the clinical side, because we do not look at and say, this meal is healthy, So therefore, it's healthy for Sharon and Monique. We're looking at what is healthy just for you. And that means that we are actually building those recommendations in real time, all the way laddered up to all of those preferences, to all of those macro micronutrients, in a way that we can support over 50 of the most common conditions in the United States. And then also those health profiles can be further customized by providers for those complex conditions where we're looking at, you know, three comorbidities, and we're looking at impacts in their lifestyle where they have functional limitations, or perhaps they've just gotten out of hospital, they've been discharged, and they need ready-made meals for a certain period of time. So we manage, as a platform, we manage all of those considerations. And we have been incredibly fortunate that dietitians that we work with had seen the opportunity of automating that part of their role. Our biggest advocates have been dietitians, and we've had no less than 1,000 dietitians directly contribute to our algorithms. And we've had working groups, we've had early adopters. They have helped to bring us in the organizations, whether it was the fitness, whether it's pro sports teams, whether it's an integrative and functional medicine clinic that you might go to. In those cases, we've been able to build the clinical base and then be able to expand outward to more lifestyle as needed by the general public.
Yeah, I think this is just tremendous and phenomenal. You know, as somebody in healthcare, trying to guide people to what's appropriate, like you said, meeting people's preferences culturally, medically, making it practical, like at the, you know, when they're home and not in a doctor's office. How do you make decisions until you see your doctor 6 months from now? And this is such a powerful way to do it. For people listening who are interested in integrating this type of program into their lives, is the pathway to meet with a specific dietitian? Is there a website of dietitians they can access that can help them? How can people access this as a resource?
So we would be delighted to refer any of your audience to a dietitian who's using Eat Love. They will probably find that many of their doctors, like if they mention, listen, like they're writing a nutrition prescription. So let's take the example of cardiovascular health and the physician has heart disease. Having there, and they'll say, why don't you see a dietitian? Most dietitians now, I would say, have heard of Eat Love. We have been serving dietitians for 5 years now. That being said, they can email us at support@eatlove.is, Eat Love being one word. We will absolutely refer to them a dietitian who's using Eat Love. If they want to use the web version, they can go straight to eatlove.is and sign up for a free trial, and they can use the platform, again, for general healthy diet. It just depends on what their needs are and what they feel like doing. And we wanted to make those options open to everyone. We do see that when you work with a medical professional, there are inherent benefits to that. There's accountability, there's education, there's motivational interviewing. It's very helpful. I worked with a dietitian last year and found it extremely helpful, even with the role that I do. I think there's different ways for different people, depending on how much time, depending on your resources. Often, after the Affordable Care Act, many preventative services around MMT and general healthy diet counseling are covered by insurance, and a lot of folks don't know that. And I paid out of pocket for my dietitian only to find out 6 months later my insurance company would have covered it. So it's definitely something to look at. And I know a lot of employers, we do work with employers. That's another piece where they can ask their employers because they can get coverage through their FSA or HSA.
Mm-hmm. And we'll provide the link to your website on the show notes for people listening so that they can reach out if they're interested or even try the version of it. With the time we have left, Monique, I have one final question. Where do you think the future is for healthcare integrated with digital technology? Like, where do you think we're headed with this?
Big question. I'll take it from the lens probably most helpful for your audience. I'll take it in the lens around food as medicine, because that is enabled by technology, because you're connecting the medical diagnosis with the fulfillment partner and then how life happens. I think that you will see, especially in a value-based healthcare environment, you will see a more of a commitment to innovation to reduce cost utilization that is evidence-based, that's improving outcomes. I'm very optimistic. The data that has come out recently, Blue Shield Blue Cross of North Carolina, Dr. Lumpkin, who was an advisor to mine when I was in Washington, released a report out in March of this year that showed that the reduction was $139 per member per month who received medically tailored meals and nutrition counseling. I think there's that. There's other. Seth Berkowitz did some great studies over the last couple of years that come to mind that have shown cost savings up to $220, and that's net of food, actually. So I think what you're going to find, and you alluded to this, Sharon, around social determinants of health, health outcomes are being driven by far more than what's happening in the doctor's office. And there's some discussion of that's 10% or 20%, but life, the 80% of life that's happening and where you live and what access to transportation and food insecurity, these are going to be the most critical issues, I believe, in the next 5 to 10 to 20 years around access. And I'm excited by the innovation within technology to democratize that access. And I find if you looked at what would have taken someone with the correct qualifications to create the recommendations that Eat Love is doing millions of times, right? We're able to do that in less than a second. I think it's going to make providers, one, feel like they have the tools to be able to support, so they're not just handing a pamphlet. I don't think providers really enjoy handing a static document where they're like, okay, here's some education. They want to be able to wrap their guidance around the patient 24/7. And I think because that guidance is now seamlessly integrated into a grocery basket, all of a sudden, people are coming for the aspiration of nutrition, but they're staying because they got 90 minutes less of having to go grocery shopping or sending their spouse or, you know, their kids to the supermarket. So I think it's that convenience and the commitment to having it be evidence-based, which I'm most hopeful about. And I think technology is only making that more possible. One note I will make to your audience is that we've seen so much conversation about generative AI. I do agree that it's going to be one of those moments where we look back and think, holy cow, things have changed beyond our recognition in the future. I do think we'll remember this time. However, I think looking at AI all as one bucket is misleading, because if you look at something like a ChatGPT and you ask for, we'll take the diabetes, for example, ChatGPT and other models like it who have not been trained on Lena and the data, for example, that Eat Love has been collecting for 8 years, is actually provides incorrect information. And we see this, and I see this every day. So it's really important where those sources are. And in fact, because Eat Love is a HIPAA-compliant platform, our data and is protected, our data is actually learning off of our own models, not being connected to the rest of the outside universe, which, you know, you can't control and you can't verify. So I think it's important where your data comes from. All of our data has been verified by dietitians and technologists. It's very different than just like a open. And so I would just encourage your audience to look at where the sources are and to be conscious that the large language models do like to hallucinate, and they like to hallucinate. It's the worst case scenario where they like to hallucinate and seem very confident at the same time. I think there was one that I looked at where I was like, okay, tell me what I should eat for this. And it had that a sweet potato had 76% fat. That's just wrong. And so I think that's one of the reasons why folks will come to Eat Love and other medically verified sources of information. But I'm optimistic.
Yeah, that's such a good reminder, because some of the AI, like you mentioned, is really just pulling off the internet, which could...
Only as good as like your one real good search fest.
Absolutely.
So if you find... So this idea of everything on the internet is not true, well, think of it like that. Whereas look for information that's been verified. And I think that's why, you know, I'm so delighted that you had me today and that you're... someone of your caliber and experience is reaching out to the public and saying, here's information, here's something that, you know, that I've vetted, that I've looked at. I think it's just, that's going to be the big question, right? How do you feel confident that the information you're receiving is a source that you trust?
I think that makes all the difference. Well, Monique, thank you so much for all this information and really for creating the resource. I mean, I feel like you are continually pushing the envelope in terms of what is possible in the digital space. I think that it's going to have manyfold benefit for people within healthcare and for all the patients and people involved. So thank you for the perseverance for all the years it's taken to do the research and build these models and continually iterate to make them better. So thanks for all that you do.
Yeah, I'll take the lovely compliment and I'll share it with my team, because I would not be here. There's a lot of people that I work with. And you just mentioned that on culture. I just think that it's very rare that people, and I think when you have it, you should cherish it, that they go to work every day and like they miss their peeps if they don't see them. Like long weekend, we get separation anxiety. We're very lucky that the team of Eat Love, I guess they don't call us Eat Love for nothing. So thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode and share it with a friend. Until next time, do something to help improve your whole health naturally.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of any entities they represent.